I could while away the hours, conferring with the flowers.
It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. If only I had a brain, I would have remembered that today is the anniversary of the Wizard of Oz premiere, and it was here in Wisconsin. Fortunately, our producers reminded me it had a soft opening the movie did in Oconomowoc on this day in 1939.
Is the Wizard of Oz a favorite of yours? Maybe required watching at your home at least once a year? Post on the Central Time Facebook page and let us know.
We'll watch for your comments. Maybe share them on the show later on today or tomorrow. First, though, as college students return to their campuses across the country this fall, fewer of their peers are going to be joining them.
And after years of growth, college enrollment is down this year.
Last year, there was a decline in enrollment in community colleges and for-profit. This year, the traditional four-year colleges are down, too.
We'll be taking your calls during this segment. Are you one of the people who chose to head straight into the workforce? Did you go to college? And what question question the importance of it for getting a job? Is college still as relevant as ever for you?
Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email, talk@WPR.org. Well, we've got Nick Hillman with us here. He's a brand new assistant professor of educational leadership and policy analysis at UW-Madison. Just came over from Utah. Professor Hillman, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, is this drop in college enrollment a surprise, or have you seen it coming for a long time?
Well, I've seen it coming only because I study college enrollment and college finances, and demographers have seen this coming for a while because the number of high school graduates peaked in 2010. That means that in 2010, that was the most number of high school graduates that we've seen in the country, and then it started to drop, so the writing was on the wall a couple few years ago, and it's not going to rebound probably until the 2020s.
Why will it take so long?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, is just the sort of demographic trend in the families not having as large of families today, and partially because the baby boomers are their kids are grown up and out of the house, and that next generation is kind of a lull here. So it's sort of an echo that we're experiencing in 2020.
Now, over the course of the Great Recession, I heard that, or at least anecdotally, heard of a lot of people going to college, staying in college, going into grad school, in part biding their time until the job market opened up more. Did we see an increase then? And is that, are we seeing that taper off now?
That's right. That anecdote is repeated over and over in communities across the country where community college enrollments increased significantly during the Great Recession and leading up to it because unemployment rates were so high, families and individuals were looking for a chance to retool and go back into the labor market. So now that we're sort of turning the corner a little bit and unemployment rates are still stagnant but and high, but better than they were, enrollments are starting to drop a little bit, likely because people have that other option of going to work.
It seems like a traditional four-year college isn't quite the key to getting a decent job, or so it seems this year, or and maybe in this economy. Has it ever been that way before?
Well, yeah, I think it's not been that way forever, and I don't know that it ever will be, because education is a really strange enterprise to be in. There's no guarantee that you'll get a degree. There's not even a warranty if you get a bad degree. You can't return it. It's all in your head. Nobody's going to take it away from you, that education that you've developed over the years. And so it's really this unknown. You're taking a gamble when you invest in your education. And the question is whether or not that gamble is going to pay off. And for better or worse, a lot of families, a lot of individuals that are trying to get out of poverty, trying to have some economic stability in their life, are wondering, how is this job going to translate? I'm sorry, how is this education going to translate into the job market? And so that's what one of the questions is. But that's not the only function of education, but it's an important one.
On the other hand, might there be trends going in the other direction? If maybe 5 years ago, and maybe even 10 years ago, you would ask someone, what do I need to get a job? And the answer would be, you need a bachelor's degree. You need to get a bachelor's. But now is the market so saturated with people holding bachelor's degrees that there's a race now to get postgraduate degrees?
Sure. Yes and no. There's a demand for high-skilled labor. And that comes through formal education, post-secondary education, community colleges, baccalaureate degrees, even graduate level degrees. There are some estimates that about two-thirds of the jobs over the next couple of decades are going to require some post-secondary credential. It doesn't necessarily mean that's a four-year degree. A lot of those credentials are going to be the vocational training through a certificate or an associate's degree program. So those are still in high demand as well. But there's still a lot of demand for even more specialized training that takes longer to do, like graduate school work, for example.
There's been a lot of talk lately about the decline of manufacturing jobs and really the end of an era where you can have a middle-class salary with a high school education. So even if the bachelor's degree isn't enough to guarantee a job, obviously, without it, are you, or with, at least without a good technical degree that you talked about, are you just really out of luck?
Well, it seems to be the case that it is tougher to get by without a formal degree, but it's also tough to get by even with them. It's tough to get by altogether, and we've seen this with median family incomes really flattening out since the Great Recession. And what this translates into is sort of intergenerational inequalities, where you've already had a really stratified system of higher education where people who can afford to attend do and aren't really affected by the these trends in tuition, trends in student loans that we've been seeing lately. But it's the families who are already struggling. They're trying to raise kids in these environments, in this context where college is even more out of reach. And so it's for these individuals even more difficult.
And you just mentioned student loans as well. And that's on that gamble side of things. We've talked on this show about people being stuck with student loan debt way into their lives. Is that having a deterrent effect now?
Yes, now and then and in the future.
Okay.
And I'm speaking from personal experience, accumulating a whole bunch of loan debt, but it really has paid off in my individual circumstance only because I've been able to fortunately find a job. But this is not the case for a lot of people who are studying at certain institutions that maybe are guaranteeing a job in the future, and then they don't actually come through and deliver them the kind of education that does prepare them for the workforce. And a lot of those colleges are seeing drops in their enrollments. And maybe that's a good thing in terms of public policy that some of these institutions that aren't serving students well are starting to be affected by enrollment declines.
Some contend that college is a crucial period of time for kids to get out of the bubble of their home or their hometown and have new life experiences as independent adults. And it's an experience that cannot be replicated any way else. Do you agree with that? And how is there, I guess, maybe a cheaper way to get similar life experience?
Oh,
if
yeah,
other, you
yeah.
know, instead of college, what other types of experience in education might people think about?
Sure. That's a great question. And I guess the answer is depending on how creative and how willing one is to take risks. And not everybody has the sort of propensity to take risks if they're risk averse in terms of accumulating a lot of debt or not trying the education system, thinking they can be entrepreneurial and get by. And that might work very well for people who have the right sort of circumstances in place. But it is a risky deal. Personally, I wouldn't want to take that risk. And a lot of state officials are saying the you think a college is expensive. Well, it's even more expensive to not get an education.
Speaking of the starting circumstances, a lot of people don't have this option, right? I mean, if you don't have the means to go to college, you also don't have the means to travel for a couple of years or do some other experience that doesn't come with a paycheck every couple of weeks.
Exactly, exactly. And is that fair? That's the question that these issues really eventually boil down to, equity of who participates, who gets the opportunities to the type of education that these colleges are delivering. And over the past couple of decades, all of the new enrollment growth that had been occurring in the last couple of decades, since at least the mid-90s, you've seen a real divergent pathway where the white students who are entering higher education are participating in the most well-resourced institutions, the most highly selective colleges, the ones that can really provide not just resources financially and academically for their students, but these sort of non-pecuniary ones too. And then you see Latino students and African-American students sort of tracked into open access colleges and community colleges that don't necessarily have the same degree of resources available. And so you have real unequal opportunities here that that are important to really get down to and figure out in terms of how this enrollment expansion can change individuals' life chances.
We're talking to Nick Hillman. He's Assistant Professor of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison.
We saw some numbers recently about declining college enrollment. We're talking about why that is and what it means. Coming up, we'll talk about what it might mean for the educational institutions that are seeing a decline in students and the corresponding income that they get. We want to hear from you with your story, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Why did you make the decision, or your kids maybe, to go to college or to not go to college? Looking back, do you wish you'd done things differently? Gone if you didn't? Didn't go if you did? 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time.
I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time. We're talking about this year's decline in college enrollment. Our guest is Nick Hillman, Assistant Professor of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison.
With your calls in just a couple moments at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Before we go to the phones, though, Nick, I wanted to talk about this from the other side. If universities, if colleges are seeing enrollment decline, they're also seeing revenue decline. How will they deal with this?
Absolutely. And that's the question they're asking, too. Colleges, many of them, even public colleges, but this is primarily in the private nonprofit institutions, your private campuses around the state, around the country. But anyhow, public sector institutions are very reliant on tuition revenue. In some cases, almost half of their revenue or even more comes from students. And in the private sector, the private nonprofit colleges, that's definitely the case. And they charge $30,000, $40,000 on the sticker price of tuition. And then they do what's called tuition discounting. They try to manipulate the financial aid package in a way that entices a student to come to campus, but that student still give some money to the institution, almost like when you order a plane ticket. You're all going to the same destination, but the person next to you probably paid a different price for their ticket because the airlines know that maybe that person has a higher price point than you. Who knows how it works, but colleges are trying to do this kind of a modeling of enrolling students and getting their revenues with them. And so private nonprofit colleges are really in a scramble right now trying to figure out how they can do what's called enrollment management, strategic enrollment management, how they can ensure that their students not just apply to the institution, but come once they think they're going to enroll and are retained for all 4 years. And so you'll see a lot of institutions probably doing more outreach to encourage students to stay on campus and to be retained from year to year. And that's absolutely a bottom line function. And oh, by the way, is an educational function too. And so it's really a question of which of these is the highest priority. And times like these, it gets questionable sometimes.
Let's take a call from Jacqueline in Rushford, Minnesota. Hi, Jacqueline.
Hi.
What's your question or comment?
I just wanted to talk about the other side of the story, not being, not attending college and being able to go directly into the workforce. Or in my case, I am working in an apprenticeship to become a home birth midwife. And so I work closely with a midwife at home birth and as her birth assistant, and I am able to also on the side have supplemental income by bartending, and I also work in an organic farm that allows me to get the free education that I'm getting through an apprenticeship and then also working towards getting to where I want to be as a home birth midwife.
Thanks, Jacqueline. So what about that? Are we seeing an increase of apprenticeships and other similar opportunities for people?
Yes, that's a really interesting example, and I think it really can illustrate one of the common trends across the country in what's called competency-based education, where instead of the number of credit hours that a student accumulates representing their degree, so 120 credit hours means you've got a bachelor's degree, some colleges, many of them online and many of them newer institutions, are having students take exams, and however they administer them, I'm not really certain, but some sort of way to the institution can gauge whether or not that individual has the capabilities and the expertise in the subject area. And if so, then they just bypass the credit system altogether and award a degree. Now, these are not common, But I think that the example of the apprenticeship is sort of similar, and we might be seeing more of that. And it's something that has actually been around for a long time, of course, but institutions are kind of figuring out ways to continue to recruit more students to campus.
Thanks for the call. We'll go back to the phones now with Brian in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Brian.
Hi there. I just wanted to comment, I guess. I'm a product of community colleges and technical schools, and I think in my personal experience, it seems like a big disservice for guidance counselors, especially in high school, to not, at least in my personal experience, they never really told me, you know, look at the trades or look at technical degrees. Right now, I've never had more jobs to pick from, which sounds probably stupid to a lot of people, but I don't know anybody out there that can basically look for a handful of jobs right now and make $30 an hour other than an electrician, plumber, or the like. It just seems like more emphasis could be placed on kind of advertising the fact that, you know, if a four-year traditional school is not what your child wants to do or if it doesn't fit, you may have a good run of luck with technical degrees.
Brian, let me ask you, if your counselors weren't pointing you there, how did you find your way into the community college, technical college system?
Dumb luck. I guess I went the first couple of years I went to a community college in the hometown that I was from, a UW system school, and just, you know, went as far as I could without declaring a major, basically, because I still didn't have the world experience to know exactly what I wanted to do for a career, so I went into the world of work, and after a few years, did find a kind of a niche that I did enjoy doing. That company, unfortunately, went out of business in, 2008, when just about everything kind of collapsed. And I was looking at my list of options with just a two-year associate of general studies, and there's, you know, just like a lot of four-year degree candidates right now, certain jobs will, let you get hired if you've got any four-year degree, but I don't know of too many that are looking for a four-year degree in, gotcha, literature or art history, or, while those are very good and I would encourage my own children to go through some study like that just to become a well-rounded.
Gotcha. Thanks for the call, Brian. Actually, that brings up an interesting point, Nick, about college as an instrumental thing that gets you a job or college as something that makes you well-rounded. Can you weigh those two against each other, please?
Sure. They don't always have to be a trade-off, one or the other. And that's the tension that community colleges have and four-year institutions have, and what Brian was illustrating is that, you want the security in the labor market, but you also want to have some experiences that aren't necessarily restricted to the job. So one of the challenges with this is that we've got a sector of higher education, the proprietary sector, the for-profit sector, that enrolls about 10% of the students across the whole country. And these colleges are your University of Phoenix, ITT Tech, for example, and they promote and they market their product quite aggressively. And they're banking on students like Brian, who aren't really sure about their educational options. They're not sure where they want to go. And these companies can go out there and recruit these individuals and have them enroll in their colleges as opposed to the community colleges and technical schools. And what ends up happening is these individuals who participate in the proprietary institutions, these online colleges, a lot of times accumulate way higher debt than those who attended the community college, the public community colleges. And so I just would hope that individuals who are in a similar circumstance or are thinking about how to retool and find that job security, weigh out all those options for sure. These online colleges might be convenient, but about 50% of all the nation's student loan defaults can be accounted for by students who attended those colleges.
Well, thinking about the impact on the institutions, we recently spoke on Central Time about financial troubles for historically Black colleges and universities. Are colleges across the spectrum going to be shuttered as enrollment falls, especially the ones that are already struggling now?
They might, and they likely will, I think, because it's going to change their financing model. Some colleges have history of having low tuition and having a real core mission of serving a certain profile of students. And when push comes to shove, it's really going to question their not just their integrity in terms of their educational priorities and their mission, but also how savvy they are in the marketplace. So some colleges aren't going to be able to compete with wealthier ones who can recruit and entice students with tuition discounting.
You know, as enrollment declines, are colleges going to look further afield, or are they going to look for more, say, foreign students to fill those empty chairs?
Yeah, they will, and they have. And a lot of the growth in the next 10 years at least, up to 2020s, is going to be with adult learners as well, and international students for sure, non-traditional students. Higher education has not done a great job of serving the entire span of individuals who are interested in post-secondary education. So this actually might be a nice motivator to get colleges to be more responsive to people.
Well, Nick, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Nick Hillman is Assistant Professor of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison.
The news is next, and then we'll hear how Act 10 has affected teachers in Wisconsin since it became a law a couple years back. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about whether or not we still need car dealerships in today's economy.
But first, we'll talk about the employment landscape for teachers since Act 10 passed in Wisconsin.
Now, this was reported in the Oshkosh Northwestern Media. The Wisconsin Education Association Council, or WEAC, and the Wisconsin Association of School Boards say school districts are letting more teachers go since Act 10 became law. Act 10, that was part of the budget bill back in 2011 that spurred protests, those huge protests at the state capitol that dramatically reduced collective bargaining rights for a lot of public sector unions, including teachers in Wisconsin.
Here to talk about this story is Randall Garshinsky, an attorney with the Wisconsin Education Association Council, or WEAC. Randall, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you, Cynthia.
So as I understand it, there's no formal tracking of how many people have been let go or have been fired from their teaching jobs. So how has WEAC determined how many have been let go?
Well, we don't have an exact number at this point in time that I can give you, but the members will be confronted with a termination or non-renewal, and they work with their regional Uniserv directors to deal with the problem, and then that is very often referred to the legal division if something can be done in regard to a hearing or a negotiation of an exit agreement or resignation in lieu of termination or non-renewal. And those instances are up substantially in terms of our case workload here at WEAC.
This might be a technical question, but it might also be very important to distinguish. So the headlines have been saying that more teachers are fired. Is it an actual firing as we understand what firings to be, or is it just a matter of contract renewal and non-renewal?
It's really more contract renewal and non-renewal, and I think that speaks to the fact that this isn't really getting rid of bad teachers for bad acts. There's always been historically a difference between terminating somebody for doing something very outrageous and then non-renewing a teacher. If you non-renew a teacher, there's a window of time within the spring that the teacher is entitled to notice they're not going to be renewed for the next year, and they can go through a procedure of having a private conference with the board and discussing that non-renewal. But they're teaching throughout the remainder of the year until that contract is over. So historically, the non-renewals have been for relatively minor things, possibly even layoffs for the coming season, not true firings or terminations. Now we're not seeing really an increase in terminations, but the school boards are using more and more the non-renewal process to eliminate teachers who would never have been subject to termination under a just cause standard that we used to have under the collective bargaining agreements or even within the non-renewal process itself. So you're finding increase in that kind of termination of contracts, not the firing in a traditional sense. You do something wrong, your employer comes over, points a finger at you like Donald Trump does and declares you're fired. It's a different process that's going on, but it's being used more and more in my opinion, and a lot of people's opinions, because there is no more just cause standard. They don't have to prove up a reason. They can simply non-renew the contract.
Are the standards well known and understood, though? Is a teacher, I guess, informed about whether or not they are meeting those standards before they receive the non-renewal?
Well, there are no standards for non-renewal. They don't even, under the statute, even have to give you a reason for the non-renewal. You can when they give you that notice of non-renewal, they don't even have to tell you why. And then you can ask for a private conference to discuss what it is. But then that reason is simply whatever reason they come up with under the current Post Act 10 law. They do not have to give a just cause type of reason for you having done something wrong, not performed your job functions or duties, or having done something else that would be a dismissible offense.
Is there any recourse?
Very little, and that's part of the problem with Post Act 10. There used to be recourse where the employees could grieve the termination or non-renewal, and then there would be a hearing in front of a neutral hearing board, the WERC, the Wisconsin Employment Relations Commission. And through that process, both sides would present their case to a neutral arbitrator, and the matter would be heard and resolved. Now, it's sort of the perception is the prosecutor, judge, and jury are all the same, because the school district brings the non-renewal. You can have a conference with the school board, which is the school district. You can go to an independent hearing officer, but the independent hearing officers are by and large management-oriented attorneys or human resource people from other districts. And then the final appeal is to the board itself again. So the perception is that this is not much of a really truly due process, a fair due process and fair hearing, because the same people that initiated the complaint against you and approved the initial non-renewal or termination are the ones who hear the final appeal. It creates an incredible perception of unfairness. I know there are a lot of people out there in school districts who are trying to be fair. I'm not saying that they're intentionally being unfair, but the process itself is set up so that it is, at the very least, perceived as prejudiced or biased, and very often, in fact, functions that way. And it's causing then, therefore, a lot of teachers who are presented with non-renewal for a very amorphous or arbitrary reason to then negotiate a resignation instead of going through this process and having on their record a non-renewal or what amounts to a firing in common parlance. Mm.
Aren't there federal laws in place to protect teachers and other employees from unfair dismissals like this?
Very limited. Mm. We have Act 10, which dismantled 50 to 60 years of collective bargaining and took away a tremendously fair and equitable vehicle for resolving disputes, that is, having both sides go in front of a neutral, the WERC Commission, and their arbitrators. Took that away. And that was decades and decades of history of being able to resolve labor disputes in a timely, efficient, and manner that was perceived by both sides as fair and unbiased.
I'm wondering if you have a sense of the mood among teachers right now. Are they a bit fearful, a bit less secure about their employment right now?
They're a mixture of emotions. There's resentfulness at having their rights taken away by Act 10. There's fearfulness that they have no longer even the basic rudimentary protections of the concept of just cause when they're charged with something or being dismissed. And they're seeing many of their fellow professionals being subjected to non-renewal situations that would have never risen to the level of just cause under the prior collective bargaining agreements or with that standard now being dismissed. And there's a very much a feeling of concern and a feeling of unfairness and a feeling that the playing field is tilted very much against them by this what Act 10 has done to this whole process.
Well, on the other hand, supporters of Act 10 would say that these changes provide more flexibility and the ability to maybe put more effective teachers in the schools. What do you say to that?
I say they're feeding a myth and they're feeding on some very untrue facts. With just cause was no magical panacea that or shield for ineffective or bad teachers. It's predicated on some basic fundamental rights of knowing what our offense is, having a fair hearing, and ultimately having the punishment fit the crime, having had to have done something that truly merits termination or the economic death penalty, if you would have it. Now, without that, there are no standards to restrain boards or administrators. They could always get rid of a truly bad or ineffective teacher if they simply went through the process of building their case, documenting the fact that this teacher is ineffective, warning them that they are ineffective, and if they don't change, there's going to be some penalties, and then finally the evaluation and the hearing and termination for not meeting the standards of effectiveness. This has always been there. Good administrators, effective administrators, have never had any problem getting rid of truly bad or ineffective teachers. This is just a huge red herring that's been thrown out there by people who I believe are truly in opposition of the whole idea or concept of a teacher's union or association to protect their rights.
Well, Randall, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Randall Garshinsky, an attorney with WEAC. We'll get another perspective on the story tomorrow.
Next, we'll talk about whether or not we still need car dealerships. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
If you're in the market for a brand new car, that means a trip to the dealership, no matter whether you're overwhelmed by the experience or can't wait to check out the shiny cars in the showroom.
But one company is trying to shake up the dealership model now. They want to be able to sell cars directly to the consumer. That's being met with resistance from auto dealers. What's this going to mean for potential car buyers? And from a business perspective, do car dealerships still make sense?
Joining us now is Brett Burke. He's a contributing writer to Popular Mechanics and has a recent piece titled, Do We Really Need Car Dealerships Anymore? It's linked on our Central Time Facebook page. Brett, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, to help us understand, tell us how the car dealership model first began.
Okay, well, it started out, you know, early on, car makers could sell directly to consumers, but when production capacity increased, you know, with the assembly line process and all of that, they had this greater capability of sort of disseminating cars in a wider way than one at a time. And so they set up this model that allowed them to gain sort of greater geographic reach quickly and with minimal investment on their part by, you know, selling franchises to dealerships. So they could get a foothold in larger territory, you know, further away from where they were manufacturing their product more readily by having dealers sort of take on some of this financial risk. And so as time went on, states enacted some laws that were designed in part to sort of prevent corporate ownership of these dealerships. They wanted to keep away the opportunity for dealers to give special treatment to stores that they were running personally, that the corporations were running, versus individually owned dealers. So in a nutshell, that's the source of the current model.
We'll get into a new challenge to those dealerships, but in a nutshell, fast forwarding to today, does it make sense? Does this franchise model still work?
It's a really good question, and I think it's a complicated one. And I think that from my perspective, it's hard to advocate 100% for one or the other. If we have a model where 100% of the time manufacturers are selling directly to consumers, we end up no one wants to live in a company town, so to speak, right? No one wants to make all their purchases from the company store if manufacturers are the only ones setting prices. On the flip side, if we have a model where it's solely these franchises that are granted to dealers and that are protected against anyone sort of infringing on that, we have something of a retail protected retail monopoly on the part of the dealers. And so I think it's possible that there's room within the system for more than one model. It's just a question of how then that can be sort of accessed by people, how that can be looked at by the government in a way that makes sure that that practices are fair on both sides, and that a manufacturer-owned store isn't undercutting or underpricing a local concern. So there's all of those questions.
Well, from a consumer standpoint, would you say that there are benefits of a dealership model, and what would they be?
Sure. I think there's benefits to both sides, actually. From a dealership model, one of the big benefits is that, and the dealers will tell you this themselves as well, is this idea of sort of a local connection. And as much as we live in a global economy, quote unquote, we still live our lives as consumers, oftentimes very locally. It might not be entirely the case for everybody, but I live in New York City. There's plenty of things that I could access, and have delivered online that I don't. I have those relationships with local merchants who know me, who know my needs, who can be flexible in ways that sometimes an online site cannot be. And I think that can be the case as well with dealerships who have an understanding of their local consumer base, what their wants and desires are, what their needs are, and things like that, and who can be connected to the community in a way that supports the community. And I think there's something to be said for the idea that, of a local economies being fueled by local community based organizations, local community based retailers.
So now there's a challenge here from the Tesla company, an alternative energy type of car, and they're saying, hey, we want to sell right directly to the consumer. What's the reaction to this?
Well, there's a few things. In some states there are outright bans on this occurring. In Texas, for example, that's not allowed, and that so they're stuck in Texas without access to that model of selling directly to consumers. In other states, there's some. If you are a company that has never had independent dealerships, it's impossible for Tesla, not having ever had any franchises out there, to compete with their franchises. They don't exist. So they're finding ways to sort of make their way into the marketplace in other states where there's less restrictive laws or where there's sort of more openness for interpretation in terms of the laws. And I think there's benefits, there's benefits there to consumers and to manufacturers. There's been some, looking at sort of the additional cost of the dealership, dealer franchises and that whole system. It's founded on dealers keeping, a large and varied selection of vehicles on their lots that people can sort of come and pick and choose from, which requires, significant overhead for the dealer, significant carrying costs and things like that. So some of that, if it was a built to order situation, some of those costs might be eliminated. I think from the manufacturer's perspective as well, that's one of the big things. That being an automotive writer, manufacturers are very much in control of their product development, in control of trying to make the best product they can, in control of sort of their brand messaging and their marketing and their public relations. But they're not in control of their dealership experience to a large degree. They can place certain strictures on how they want the dealership to appear and what kinds of customer service practices they would prefer to have occur, but the dealership is an independently owned business, and that doesn't always match up. So your experience in purchasing even a luxury vehicle sometimes may not feel, and for anyone who's ever been to the dealership, you can attest to that, may not feel like a luxurious experience.
In our last minute here, if Tesla wins, whatever exactly that looks like, and they're successful somehow in selling direct to consumers, are other automakers looking at this and thinking, hey, maybe we can do without the franchise model?
I think that it's definitely possible that other people are sort of waiting, other manufacturers are waiting to see how this is going to play out and see how they could get in on the action. I think, you know, there's definite interest from both sides. It's just the question of sort of then what does that model look like? Where do people go to do their test drives? Where do people go to have their servicing done? Is that a manufacturer-owned store? Is that a local independent dealership? How does all of that play out? So I think there's a lot of questions that remain to be answered. I think, you know, it's like everything Tesla does, it's exciting and interesting and different. So I think there's something to be very much there to be supported in terms of the way that they've approached this.
Briefly, are they going to win, or are they going to be shut down by the current dealers association?
I have no way of predicting that. I think I think they're having some successes right now. When I talk to the folks from Tesla, they talk about having a dealer franchise organization at some point in the future when they're larger. Right now, they're a very small scale manufacturer. So I think, you know, it's not a question of necessarily defeating this whole franchise operation and closing it down and making it a total, you know, manufacturer-led initiative. I think there's, you know, like I said earlier, it's probable that there's room in the system for both of these things to coexist. Just a question of how, figuring that out.
Brett, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Brett Burke. His piece, Do We Really Need Car Dealerships Anymore, is in Popular Mechanics, linked to on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk to a guest who says it's hard to find courage in an age of anxiety, but our bravery is there and we need to use it.
That's tomorrow on Central Time.